program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. You can find more audio online at KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
The 2024 election is coming, and we at KBOO want to make sure your voice is heard. Take KBOO's Election Agenda Survey and help our volunteer reporters and programmers cover the 2024 election. We want to know, what do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Fill out our survey by August 14th, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card. Full rules on our website. At the end of August, we'll report back with the community's priorities. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOOSurvey24. That's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey24. Thanks for your help.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hello, and you're listening to Eco Justice Radio. We present environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jack Eit. On today's show, how climate justice can remake a world in crisis. Host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Osprey Oriel Lake, founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, or WECAN. Osprey Oriel Lake, through her organization WECAN, works internationally with grassroots Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and Indigenous leaders, policymakers, and diverse coalitions to build climate justice, resilient communities, and a just transition to a decentralized, democratized, clean energy future. She recently released her book, The Story Is in Our Bones, How Worldviews and Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, today we welcome Osprey Oriel Lake, author of The Story Is in Our Bones, How Worldviews and Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis. She's also the founder of the WECAN Network. And we are going to dig into the bones around her work with grassroots, BIPOC, and Indigenous leaders and diverse coalitions globally to manifest the world we wish to see. One which honors nature with sacred reciprocity and is guided by Indigenous worldviews and leadership, earth-centered communities, decentralization, equity, and true democracy. May this world be the inheritance of future generations. We thank the Tongva ancestors for their enduring legacy, presence, and stewardship of this region as our show comes to you from the ancestral homelands of the Tongva. We invite listeners to engage, align, and act with the Native Nations wherever you live to preserve and ensure their legacies for generations to come. May we act in solidarity with the Indigenous peoples who are claimed by the places we may now live. And since Osprey, you are coming from the coastal Miwok territory, is there anything you would like to say about that?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me onto your podcast. I look forward to our conversation. And yes, I feel really honored to live in the territories of the Coast Miwok, as you mentioned. You know, I agree so much that it's very important that we have these land acknowledgements that are also deepening as we all learn more about decolonization and to really recognize and visibilize the lands of where we're staying, where we're honored to live, and to also uplift Indigenous rights and the calls to action by Indigenous peoples wherever we live. So Yeah, I think it's really beautiful that we open in that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for all your longstanding decades of work on behalf of grassroots communities, Indigenous communities. It is what the calling of our times is. So it is a prescient time to return to nature and to both remember and act from ancestral cosmological worldviews. These are the Indigenous perspectives and understandings about life that will foster the reemergence and continuance of regenerative earth-centered communities for future generations. Many listeners are long familiar with the root causes behind the devastation of our times, ecologically, socially, even spiritually. Climate collapse is a symptom of our disconnection from Mother Earth and how we have abandoned our original reciprocal relationship with her. The story is in our bones. Your book opens a portal to Indigenous cosmology and the collective knowledge of Earth-centered cultures that uplift restoration and justice. By weaving together ecological, mythical, political, and cultural understandings and your own life experiences, working alongside global leaders, systems thinkers, climate justice activists, and Indigenous peoples, you summon a new way of being and thinking in the Anthropocene that opens our capacity to transform the wake of colonialism, imperialism, racism, patriarchy, capitalism, and ecocide into thriving communities for all. May we invoke the memory of our earth lineages and usher and dream in the world we wish to see. Thank you for being here with us, Osprey. We're looking forward to diving into all that has gone into this book, your life's work, and how this actually emerged for you. I wonder if you could first explain the book's title and why the story lives in our bones.
Thank you. So yes, it was an unexpected title, but I wanted to really bring the reader right away into one, an understanding that we are part and particle of the web of life. And so the stories in our bones is a way of getting our bodies engaged in this a very challenging time that we live in, and to know that we have agency, each of us, in the story of the lineages that we carry, as you mentioned. And so how do we access that ancestral knowledge and that knowledge of when our own ancestors, wherever we're from, were close to the land? And how do we reclaim that and rejuvenate that in a new way? And to be a little bit more explicit, so, you know, as you were mentioning in your introduction, we do live in these systems of oppression, which have led to what many scholars are calling a polycrisis, in which we see colonization, racism, patriarchy, capitalism, these intersectional forces, interlocking forces that we are really engaged in. And that can be very overwhelming and is obviously quite detrimental to our communities and the earth. And so one, yes, we absolutely need to respect and look at Indigenous peoples and learn to honor, respect Indigenous rights and the traditional ecological knowledge that they carry and what we can learn from Indigenous peoples, first and foremost. But also the process, from my perspective, is we also have to do a lot of our own homework about our own stories, our own traumas, our own need for healing, and bring those ancestral roots and stories forward as part of the reconstitution and healing of our society as we compost and dismantle a lot of these systems. What are we birthing? What are we growing? And where's that going to come from? And the last thing I'll say on that is I talk a lot in my book about our pre-colonial and pre-patriarchal ancestors and how do we really research those stories, get in touch with those stories, while we're also putting our hands in the soil and doing very practical things to reconnect us in our earth lineage.
And how are you encouraging people to do those very things of that reconnection to ancestors? For many people, I mean, we know many modern people, they don't carry the language of their ancestors. You know, they can't speak the language. And of course, we know in that is a cosmological worldview embedded. So wondering what you are, inviting people to do.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's not an easy journey because, you know, most of us have very tattered and torn knowledge of our past histories, may not have access whatsoever. Part of the colonial project and capitalistic project, an extractive economy project, and patriarchy has been to purposely divorce us and orphan us from those stories. So we have to remember this was intentional. And so it's going to take effort to reclaim and do the research and to reconnect, because it was no light measure. Wars have been fought over this very topic. I think there's various things in everyone's different capacities and time. So, just starting from the simplest thing, it could be, how to have a garden in your backyard if you have one, or even, growing vegetables on your windowsill if you're in a city environment. This way of just very much reconnecting with seed, power to grow our own food, and having some food justice by reclaiming our space with food, I think is one way we can just directly connect with the land and the earth. And, then extending from there, I've done a lot of research on my own ancestors, whether you're going through some of these programs that are online or doing DNA testing. I mean, I think all of these two things have pluses and minuses and have their issues of accuracy and so forth. But we can get some generalized ideas about, tracing our ancestors, especially if we go further into the past and see the lands where they come from. And there's so much archaeological evidence and stories that we can find. It's quite massive. Or just to give some examples, people might be able to, touch most immediately. Well, like when we look, many of us have European ancestry, whether it's, throughout the Eurasian steppes or throughout Europe proper, we can see all of these stone circles that many of our ancestors built that are directly related to the relationship with the land and connect people into the cycles of time. So when we start looking, actually start seeing a lot of things. And it can also be just in our family traditions, what kind of food we cook, the recipes we learned from our grandparents, or stories that we heard, or songs that are still sung in our community. So I think it's a process of, sort of knitting together maybe this broken tapestry and pulling it together and rethreading that loom and being able to then regenerate those stories in this time. And I would add to that, that I think it's a process of doing that and researching and sharing with other people. And, some of us even have looked to going back to the lands where our ancestors were from. Not everyone has access to that or the financing to do that, which makes sense, but we can certainly connect with people from those lands through email and the internet. And so there's a lot of ways we can do that. And I find it to be quite empowering and healing, because it's so important that we know where we come from as we generate this new story of how we're going to move out of these systems of oppression. We need to start imagining what we want. And it's not about going to the past, but rather how we're going to, as a lot of my Indigenous friends have told me, the future is ancestral. Like, how do we bring those ancestral knowledge pieces forward into a future context that connects us with the land?
Well, definitely, I we use that term a lot, or one of my teachers uses that term a lot, of ancient future, that it is weaving those two together, even though other cultures will have all of time collapse together as one. So, but in any case, could you also explain the cover image of the book? Is this representing something specific, or why this image? How did you come by choosing that?
Yes, I really, really love this cover. And I know that we're not doing this visually, but in case somebody is, I'm just holding it up for people who are listening.
Oh, sure.
But I'll describe the image. It's two women who are standing over a river, and they have like medicine or herbal bundles, and they are making offerings to the land. And it's the story of these, an actual river in Canada that was poisoned and polluted by industry. And the women are making prayers and making offerings over the river for the healing and restoration of the river. And it's just so much part of the theme of the book is our relationship with the earth and how we're going to restore, rejuvenate our relationship with the land to live reciprocally, but also how do we become a life-enhancing species. And the artist is a wonderful Indigenous artist from Canada. Her name is Christy Belcourt. And she's one of my very favorite artists and people. She's just a force of nature herself. And then above the women is the night sky and the universe. And as you know from reading the book, it opens up with, a wide lens to bring in the story of the stars and our place in the solar system and our place in the web of
our origins, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In our origins in a living universe, in a living cosmology.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, given your many decades standing on the front lines with Indigenous peoples, was it essential for you to have an Indigenous person write the foreword to this book? You know, how or why did you choose Zhuti, the environmental ambassador and heritage drum keeper for the Ponca Nation?
Yes, I just love, Zhuti is her traditional name, so thank you for using that. And others may know her as Casey Camp Hornick. She's an incredible elder from the Ponca Nation, a leader. She's fought for Indigenous rights all her life, environmental causes, working with Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. She is on our board of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, and also one of our coordinators for a project that is in the Ponca Nation. So we have a very deep and long-standing relationship. And she is certainly not only a friend and a loved one and family, but also a mentor. You know, I felt it was very important at this time, because so much of the work at the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, or WECAN, is centered mm-hmm. on Indigenous and Black and Brown women's voices and lifting up marginalized voices. Mm-hmm. That it was befitting that I would open my book by lifting up, you know, someone who I deeply respect in that space, who is fighting for climate justice. And so I really wanted to honor Casey as a mentor, and also use the book as an opportunity to spotlight voices that we often don't hear from, to colonization, racism, and all the things we're talking about, and those voices being marginalized. So throughout the book, there are lots of different voices shared, and I spent a lot of time, you know, quoting or, you know, in discussion with other leaders to ensure that, you know, that the book could also be a way for movement building in a really deep intersectional way. So yeah, I wanted to honor her voice to begin the book.
Mm-hmm. And how was that process for you working with Indigenous leaders? I mean, was it, you know, that trust had to be built between you over time? I mean, I know it's decades work that you've been doing this, but, you know, we know in the beginning, there's always that learning to trust, building relationship, and that takes time.
Absolutely. It is about building relationship and sitting to learn and listen. I feel like that's one of the most important things, is it's our time, if we're not Indigenous, to be really listening and learning and understanding that it's a time also of healing and reparations and accountability and justice, mm-hmm. and really putting in the labor on our end to learn and research and to lift up the leadership and lead from behind, if you will, you know, if we're going to be in partnership. Yeah, I think it's really important to recognize the incredible power of Indigenous peoples. And, you know, as we often say at WECAN, you know, Indigenous peoples are a climate solution. Their traditional ecological knowledge, their worldview, the knowledge that they have to offer is central to all of our survival. And we should just be honoring Indigenous rights because it's the right thing to do on its own, but also to recognize it is collectively imperative for all of us to understand that Indigenous people right now are stewarding 80% of all the biodiversity left on Earth. 80% of the forests, rivers, mountains is Indigenous lands and territories. So I think it's imperative that we all recognize that and understand that and honor how we're going to work in support and solidarity with Indigenous peoples.
Well, I think many of our listeners are very familiar with, you know, different prophecies and knowing that our times is truly, it's critically important, and that the Indigenous will lead in this time. That's been prophesied for a long time. And we know that is happening, but it's just a matter of continuing to expand and allowing things to also unfold. I think that's also part of that Indigenous perspective, where it's not about rushing forward all the time, but a lot of times it's about being able to observe and stepping back with humility, not always rushing out to act, but being able to sit, like you say, listen, you know, not always be the one trying to save the day or solve the day, et cetera. You know. So we are going to take a break right here, Osprey, and we'll be right back to talk more about your book. And listeners, stay with us to learn more about the story is in our bones.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps. Visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org. check out previous shows and guests, listen to extended episodes, and get connected with us on social media. Today you're listening to How Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis with host Carrie Kim and guest Osprey Oriel Lake, founder and executive director of Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, or WECAN International.
So listeners, we're back with Osprey Oriel Lake, the author of The Story Is in Our Bones. And the opening chapter, Osprey, of your book speaks about worldviews as a portal. And we've already talked a bit about that. But why is this the core entry of transformation, this portal of worldviews?
Thank you for that question. So at the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, on a daily basis, we're doing things that probably a lot of people would expect us to be doing. We are, you know, fighting fossil fuel projects and pipelines. We go to the UN climate talks every year and bring frontline women to go advocate and speak for themselves about protecting their territories. We have reforestation projects and forest protection projects and write reports and briefs and do all kinds of advocacy work. So there's a variety of work we do that is really putting out fires or trying to move legislation or put out different policies or do educational work. And all of that is essential because we are in a crisis moment. We are in a very definitive timeline that Mother Earth has made perfectly clear. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when I wrote this book, I wanted to take a moment to go upstream and look at, you know, how did we get into this polycrisis? Mm-hmm. And as you talked about at the beginning of the program, you know, looking at the root causes of these different systems of oppression, but even going upstream from there and saying, you know, how where did colonization come from? Where did the patriarchy come from? How do we actually understand the deeper levels of the kinds of thinking that got us into these systems? Because it's no different than when we go to the doctor, if you're ill, the doctor can't just start, you know, or the health practitioner can't just start throwing things at you for your healing. They actually have to really interrogate and investigate and get a good diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I became very interested in worldviews and understanding, as an example, the worldview that we have dominion over nature from the dominant society, dominion over nature, white people over other people. Where did supremacy come from? This whole worldview of that the earth is dead matter instead of being animate and a beautiful living web of life cosmology, that men should have supremacy over women or gender diverse peoples. And so this is what I was really getting at. It's like, what are these worldviews? Where do they come from? And how do we really explore transforming them and transforming ones that are really toxic and dangerous? And then also at the same time, reclaiming those worldviews that are actually really healthy, that were buried or destroyed or violently oppressed as these other systems of oppression rose in the development of civilization over the last thousands of years. And so I think we have to have a worldview perspective because we have to go deep inside about how we think, how the world came into being, you know, what are our codes of conduct with nature. All of these things are really up for grabs right now because, you know, let's say I could wave a magical wand tomorrow, which I would love to be able to do, but anyway, wand tomorrow and end the climate crisis, that would be a great thing, but it wouldn't stop environmental racism. It wouldn't stop our extractive economy. It wouldn't stop over-consumerism. It wouldn't really address how we got here. So this is why I think it's essential that we really incorporate worldview and cultural perspectives and telling stories and finding different ways of being human beings and other ways of knowing. I think it's critical. And in fact, it's a political activity. And I know many times we are taught we have to separate out these topics that, you know, this is a spiritual conversation, this is a philosophical conversation, over here is a political conversation, and we can't merge them. But I think at this point, if we don't bring our full selves, our whole selves to the table, we're actually not going to be able to make it through this crisis in any intact fashion. We, in fact, have to transform ourselves. And I think this is where the question of worldview becomes paramount.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely become fragmented. Like you say, this is political, this is spiritual, this is religious, this, everything is segmented and fragmented. And then, like you say, it's not a holistic approach to life or the ecosystem. And, you know, I'm wondering at this point, you know, what would you like to say about this term white privilege? What does that mean to you? And would you say there is any greater culpability or responsibility for anyone who might consider themselves privileged?
So this is a multifaceted topic. So I'm going to put out a few pieces because I spent a lot of time on it in the book. And, you know, really, it lends itself to a non-soundbite conversation, really, because it's so deep and it's so charged, as it
right.
should.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. It's caused enormous violence, pain, genocides, and everything else. So it should be a charged conversation. It's very complex and it's filled with trauma and pain and suffering. And so when, you know, I'm thinking about privilege, you know, obviously the first thing that comes to mind is that there is white supremacy and this ideology that somehow white people are more important than everyone else. And we swim and live in that every single day. Mm-hmm. And so as a white person, for me, this means, you know, one, a constant interior conversation about racism, about colonization, about privilege, about mm-hmm. my own thinking, about my worldviews. And I think it's a lifelong journey. I don't think like you get over racism, you get over colonization. I think that it's so deeply embedded. It's a constant learning process, a constant engagement, mm-hmm. and hopefully one that even if it's uncomfortable, which sometimes it deeply is, it's mm-hmm. also healing because, mm-hmm. you know, in our heart of hearts, you know, we want to be equitable. We want to be in egalitarian societies. It doesn't feel right to have privilege, you know, mm-hmm. if we're really honest with ourselves. I'm not saying everybody, of course, I'm making giant generalizations here that don't apply to everyone. I'm just can speak for myself and the experience yes. of my community. And so I think it's an ongoing process. And so I do think that there is a need for people who have privilege to utilize their privilege to perpetuate accountability and justice in any way that we can. You know, mm-hmm. in other words, it's white people's job to be anti-racist. It is white people's job to learn about decolonization. It's white people's job to understand why indigenous rights matter. It's white people's job to understand when black people are talking about reparations, what do they mean? Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of our job and part of our journey. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's part of our privilege is to take on that labor, that work. And you know, no matter how uncomfortable it is, it also should be joyous because mm-hmm. as they say, none of us are free until we're all free. And I totally believe that. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the journey.
Would you say part of that problem, though, is for some people who haven't, maybe generations ago, there was racism, experienced by someone's, you know, racial heritage, people in that line, but they themselves may not have experienced it. You know, there's many people who haven't actually directly experienced racism, but people who have, it's a different experience to try to explain what that feeling is, or, you know, it's that's a sort of a difference in, and a contrast. If one's never been on the receiving end of racism, it's harder to have empathy for it, or even to understand that it actually exists. I've had people, you know, have had conversations with people that don't believe that there's even such a thing as systemic racism. There's plenty of people out there that think that.
I couldn't agree more.
That's imaginary.
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely. And so that's, again, I think the role of people who are white or privileged is that education to people who say, well, it doesn't exist anymore. And then I think it's our job to share the myriad of stories we can and myriad of examples mm-hmm. that make it explicitly clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can name everything from what is going on in Gaza and Israel to Sudan to any of the communities we work with in the Gulf South in the United States that are mostly Black and brown indigenous communities who are inundated with the fossil fuel extraction and pipelines in their communities. I mean, the examples of how racism exists is so gigantic that there's mm-hmm. plenty of opportunity to, you know, hopefully gently guide people to look around and get educated, or mm-hmm. you know, maybe push them a little bit out of their comfort mm-hmm. zone to mm-hmm. open their eyes to see what people's experience is. So mm-hmm. I think, again, it's the job to people who are white people or, you know, privileged in some manner to do that work, you know, mm-hmm. so that people are educated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not only white people, because at some point it is also just a socioeconomic privilege also begins to separate people even within their own races, you know, so that is also an issue, you know.
I would agree with you. I mean, I think also wealth and the wealthy elite play into this too. And that can also, you know, be beyond racial boundaries. It can just be the wealthy elite continuing to push themselves up in the pyramid, so to speak, and make sure that their lives are maintained, which is why climate justice and all of these movements we're doing are so important, because we need to really dismantle that disparity.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a lot of these people, if they live just 1 week in a sacrifice zone, they would experience something far different. You know, the rights of nature. You serve on the executive committee for the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature, and you've been a core organizer of various international rights of nature tribunals. And I actually lament that we actually have to have something like this alliance, because it's proof positive that we have been in violation of nature, that we've been trespassing against nature for a long time. Because in a healthy functioning society, this, we know this wouldn't be necessary. It's not necessary among indigenous communities who are deeply connected to their traditions and life ways. But regardless, at this point, you know, I know you've spoken about it as a potentially systemic solution, because at least it's one way to try to stop the, you know, to stop the tide of damage. So if you could speak more about what sorts of things are happening now with rights of nature, where are you inspired by what's happening in this greater reverence for nature?
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. I think it's, you know, one of the most exciting aspects of, you know, the quote unquote environmental movement is rights of nature. It's a growing movement. You know, it fits sort of under the umbrella of earth jurisprudence, which even the UN Secretary General last year said was the fastest growing movement in the world. Because I think people are realizing our current environmental laws are not working, or we wouldn't be careening off a cliff here, looking at our own extinction. And so, you know, just in a nutshell, I think it's important to say also that, in case people aren't familiar with rights of nature, instead of viewing nature as property, which is really fairly recent human construct, that we own the forest, we own the land. Certainly this is not, you know, land-based people or indigenous people's view of how we are here to be in part and particle of the web of life. But again, this idea of supremacy over the land means that we own the land and we view the land as property. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it doesn't have legal representation in the court. And what rights of nature does is it changes sort of that DNA of how we view nature and says, no, you know, the rivers have rights. The forest has rights all on their own. They could be a rights-bearing entity and they have the right to thrive and grow and be healthy, just mm-hmm. like rights. Nature has rights. And mm-hmm. so it's pretty exciting because, you know, it's not just a great idea or an idea has come, it's in practice. Mm-hmm. In 2008, Ecuador became the first country in the world to put rights of nature into their constitution. And I've witnessed, you know, rivers in Ecuador being protected under mm-hmm. rights of nature laws. Always problems and pushback. We should never pretend it's like easeful. I mean, industry mm-hmm. right. will always push back against.
Right. You know, these and there's money, right? There's money involved. I mean, people are bought. We know this, you know.
Yeah. And there's over 39 countries now that have rights of nature legislation in process. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, there's been like over 36 cases that have stopped fracking in a community. There's local ordinances. We're very far from it being at a, you know, state or national level, but sure, that's a dream that we can hold. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll give just one other example that really has inspired me. I was on a fact-finding mission to go to New Zealand because mm-hmm. the Maori people there have a unique form of rights of nature that is not just in New Zealand, but other places where a river, in this case, the Whanganui River, was given personhood. Mm-hmm. And it's just beautiful because the Maori people fought over 100 years to protect the Whanganui River and were finally able to establish through this personhood of the Whanganui mm-hmm. River, stewardship of the river with one person from the government and one person from the Whanganui tribe being stewards mm-hmm. of the river. And yes. and I love how they see the river as their living ancestor. And I was fortunate, as I said, to go there to learn more about the implementation of this law and was able to go to the river one day with this beautiful Maori elder and hear her singing to the river. Mm-hmm. And when she was done singing, she took my hand and she said, "We have a saying here. I am the river. And the river is me. Right. And the river, and the river is me." Mm-hmm. And it was so beautiful because in that moment it was like bringing together, you know, the fact that our bodies are primarily water, mm-hmm. we are looking at this river that is our bodies, mm-hmm. this legal mechanism that is allowing us to see the living nature of this water, protect this river. And all of that came together in one moment. And it was just absolutely beautiful. And so I think rights of nature can not only impact how we protect nature and center Mother Earth in the conversation and stop the commodification and mm-hmm. financialization of nature, get nature out of the marketplace, mm-hmm. but to lift up nature, to have rights to be protected, but also to change us culturally and how we view our relationship to the land and our code of conduct with nature.
Mm-hmm. Osprey, thank you for sharing all of that. I mean, I wondered also whether you see a global possibility for this jurisprudence at that level, at a global level, that there would be this protection. I mean, the problem is that each country has their own justice system, right? But is there something that could be paramount? Would that make sense even?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're working at all these different levels on rights of nature, but one of the goals I know at the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network and in my role at the Global Alliance for Rights of Nature is to get the United Nations to adopt the Universal mm-hmm. Declaration on the Rights of Mother Earth. I mean, this has been a goal for a long time that we continue to advocate for. And yes, because we have the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, we should right. also have the rights of Mother Earth or the rights of nature at the same level. So mm-hmm. that is a goal for sure.
Mm-hmm. And the indigenous rights, I mean, I don't know if you equate that all with the same, you know, the rights of nature, indigenous rights, and all in that same declaration.
Well, the indigenous rights, I see that we have to go to the break, so I'm not sure how to handle this. Maybe I should just finish this one piece on indigenous.
Yes. Yeah, just finish this one piece and then move.
Okay. All right. So what I think is really exciting is that, you know, for many, many years, indigenous peoples fought at the United Nations level, and they now have the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which mm-hmm. was fought for many years and is quite powerful. They insisted and won the fact that while we all have human rights, they said, actually, we also need explicit indigenous rights because we have a different worldview, a different view mm-hmm. that is beyond the concept of what is held within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And they said, we see ourselves as having not just individual rights, like me as a human being having a right, but collective right. rights.
Collective rights.
On having that, and within that also a relationship to the land that they mm-hmm. hold, which is unique to indigenous peoples. And that included something called free, prior, and informed consent, which is mm-hmm. part of indigenous peoples' rights. And that is critical to so much advocacy we do around mm-hmm. the fact that we can demand from governments or corporations or financial institutions that they respect that indigenous peoples have the right to be informed and give consent or not about what is happening in their territories. And that's a huge topic, but it's really important that we continue to lift up indigenous rights in all of its complexity and its power. And it's violated every day, but it's something I think that's really important.
Right. Right. It's important to still keep fronting it, though, and centering that always. So, Osprey, we are going to go to a break again here, and then we'll come back to talk about what the new narrative might be.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps. Visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests, listen to extended episodes, and get connected with us on social media. Today you're listening to How Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis with host Carrie Kim and guest Osprey Oriel Lake, founder and executive director of Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, or WECAN International.
So listeners, we're back with Osprey Oriel Lake, author of The Story Is in Our Bones. And what do you see as the new narrative, Osprey?
Oh my goodness, all of these things. I think, you know, everything that we're talking about is part of this new narrative. People healing from a lot of trauma, people taking responsibility for how we got into this mess. I think we need a narrative of egalitarian societies. I think we need to look at new economies. You know, we have all these different examples, as an example from Bhutan, where we see, you know, ways of living where we don't have GDP as the driving force of the economy, where we're constantly looking at quarterly gains.
Right.
Look at reorienting ourselves to, you know, how well is the environment doing? How are people happy? I mean, all these other ways of viewing and valuing life is part of the new narrative. I really like a concept coming from Kichwa people in the global south of something called Tsumak Kausai, which is an understanding of progress, but it's not based on endless economic growth models. It's progress of how you are in your community and what your relationship is. What are you creating? Reciprocity with one another in the land. It's extremely expansive and has many other textures to it than how much money is your country making. And so I think this is part of the new narrative, is a big radical transformation of what is progress, what is economy, how do we actually not have the wealthy elite continue to extract and control power? How are we going to put more power into our communities and localize our governance and localize our food and watersheds? These are all part of the world many people are already participating in. I mean, it's a narrative, but you know, on a daily basis, what I see with a lot of the women leaders that are in our network is it's already happening. It's already being done. We have all these food security and food sovereignty networks here in the United States, in the Gulf South, in the Amazon, in the DR Congo, with women growing food for their communities and getting ready for the times to come. You know, we're reforesting in different countries, and it's really thrilling. And the issue is, in my perspective, this new narrative, this new way of being is something a lot of people are already invested in, engaged in, and practicing. And in many ways, I don't think we have a solutions problem. We have a huge power problem and interference with letting people do the business at hand that the people know they need to do. And this is the real challenge is, you know, how do we stop the harms and, you know, stop the sort of top-down business as usual that continues to extract, exploit, and exhaust this wonderful grassroots community work that's going on.
What sort of governance frameworks do you see supporting earth-centered communities? Do you feel that it will just be, I mean, we talked about decentralization. Do you feel it will be more about working hyper-locally and then this kind of a decentralized network of these earth-centered communities? Is that what you envision?
Completely. I think that's really well said, you know, that people can operate in a decentralized, democratized way. And be connected to larger networks. And in fact, that's also what's happening in many ways.
Right, you know, already, right, yes.
And you know, even in our movement spaces, we're all working, you know, in our corner of the world, but then we get together, whether we're at, you know, these global climate negotiations, wherever, and sharing information and advocating together. I know a lot of us are going to be going to the UN Convention of Biological Diversity, which is in Colombia later this year. And I know we all, you know, we're all doing different things, but we will get together shoulder to shoulder and push for this or that policy. So it's kind of that model of everyone being in their own bucket, but then connecting together. And I think that's really valuable. And I wanted to just mention a couple of other like frameworks that I think
about.
So we talk about rights of nature, which I think is a very important framework. I think another one is, you know, being from a women's organization, you know, all of this work around the feminist economy. We've mentioned some pieces of it, you know, as an example of Bhutan, but also degrowth and beyond growth. And, and all these different ideas about the feminist economy, I think, are really critical in developing the care economy and this unpaid labor that needs to get recognized. So that's another framework. I also wanted to mention that I've been really honored to sit on the steering committee of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty, which is really important because how are we actually going to get off of fossil fuels? We know the Paris Climate Agreement primarily deals with carbon emission reductions and has led to also a lot of false solutions and perpetuation of business as usual. But this other mechanism of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty is really powerful because it's actually only designed, specifically designed, to get governments to negotiate ending fossil fuels. And I think we have to have that because this is essential. There's no way you can put the puzzle pieces around without stopping fossil fuels. And it's an initiative that's gained a lot of momentum. There's a wonderful woman named Zipporah Berman who chairs this. And there's 13 countries now who have endorsed the treaty. And it's just gaining momentum over time. And it sort of gives governments a way to think about how there could be an international treaty on ending fossil fuels, non-proliferation of fossil fuels. And then the last one I wanted to mention, we touched upon it, but also just to lift it up again, is around Indigenous rights, and Indigenous rights being a solution, being a framework that can also, you know, protect territories and lands and Indigenous knowledge. So I feel like these are some of the frameworks that, for me, are some of the most promising as we look to, like, what can we get our hands on right now that guide us towards these new communities, these new narratives, these new ways of being. I think all of those are sort of in the realm of what helps us move that along the road.
Is there such a thing as a heritage protection? I mean, we've talked about Indigenous rights, but is there anything like that, kind of like you would protect a historic place? Is there anything that is actually like a cultural heritage protection?
Yeah, there is. I know that like IUCN has heritage sites, and there's other you know, international bodies that do protect sites of cultural significance and heritage. So they're definitely
not sites, but I mean the culture itself.
The culture itself. I'm not so familiar with that. I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think Indigenous rights falls within that sort of way of thinking, but the actual, you know, like preservations of language and ways of life, I don't know right off the top of my head if there's something specific like about that, other than like physical locations.
Right, because it makes sense, because especially when we're running up against this culture, it could be lost or become extinct, you know, as so many have. It's sort of like that kind of as a protection. But anyway, it just came to me as we were talking. So,
well, I would just also add, I mean, there might be, you know, different aspects of human rights, you know, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, that might have a place for arguing what you're talking about, you know, how to preserve.
Right, the culture itself. You know, I wanted to just share a little testimonial from Stuart Cohen, the executive director of the Buckminster Fuller Institute. And it's just a testimonial for your book, but it's a beautiful one. He says, "This book traces luminous threads of possibility arising from extractive collapse, coalescing back into reciprocity with sovereign living processes." Which that sovereignty piece of nature is so beautiful for him to express that sovereign living processes, because I think so often people, you know, nature for in large part for many people is seen as a commodity, is seen as something that we have dominion over, is seen as something that has no wish for itself. But in that sovereignty, we have to honor that and recognize that. Nature has its own wishes.
It's so true. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, is part of the new culture, the new narrative we're working on, is to return to this understanding that, you know, we are part and particle of the web of life, and that we can be here as a life-enhancing species and really learn from nature. And that means really removing this ideology of supremacy over nature, as we've been talking about, but also the joy of finding ourselves back in the womb of Mother Earth, so to speak, and part and particle of this amazing adventure on this planet. And I think that it doesn't get discussed enough. You know, sort of, I remember thinking in maybe grammar school and maybe a college course, you know, having, you know, a course on the solar system very scientifically, and it was very interesting, but it's always compartmentalized and not necessarily something we think about on a daily basis,
right,
about like, where are we situated and how amazing that is. And I think when we remove ourselves from that conversation, it becomes very difficult to think differently and make the kind of decisions we need to make, because we're not coming from a deeper analysis and a deep enough connection to be able to actually listen to Mother Earth, as you were saying, and listen to her agency and call to all of us. And that, I think that discourse, I think, has to really change in that experience for modern human beings in this, you know, hyper-individualized, commodified, high technology world, is something we're going to really struggle to reclaim and regenerate a different understanding and experience.
Right. Well, that visceral connection is an imperative. You know, that's what so many people have lost, is that actual direct experience, direct connection, touching the soil, growing something, even realizing how many people don't grow anything. They don't know what the actual process to grow anything is. You know, that's a reality for many people. You know, I wanted to diverge a little bit to land back and to property ownership. I see that really as one of the root causes of where we are and how we got here. It seems necessary to undo the imperative of land ownership that is impressive on people from day one. It's like something to strive for. And even people who are in movements that are for regeneration or ecosystem restoration, you know, there aren't a lot of people giving up their land titles, you know, so I don't know where we go from that to actually surrendering land ownership for even the people who actually envision this other world of possibility and restoration with the earth.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, it's something that I would be a little bit concerned about, like generalizing, because I think it's very, very specific. Mm-hmm. What I do see is that, one, the land back movement is growing every single day with more power, which I think is quite exciting. Right here in the Bay Area, there was a huge land back tree with the Ohlone people or Lizon mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. with Green Gould, who has been working
yes,
with
cool.
mm-hmm. incredible indigenous leader, really the matriarch of the East Bay, mm-hmm. the fight for the Shell Mound project that
right.
territories was won over, I don't know, I think it's over a decade, I don't want to misspeak, but a long time. And so we're seeing that, or like we have a food sovereignty and food security program in the Gulf South through Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And through that work and a lot of fundraising, we've done, you know, purchase land and had it go back to indigenous peoples who live there for mm-hmm. them to grow food. So I think it's happening all over the place in different ways. And I'm not so sure it's about like, you know, so like I live in a house and I'm giving up my house for someone. I think it's not quite so direct in that way. I think that there's land that are public lands or, you know, large ranches. There's mm-hmm. lands that can be rematriated mm-hmm. In land back movements that I think make right. a lot of sense. And like right. that's where we can begin. And mm-hmm. then it's something we're gonna have to keep sorting out and figuring out as we go forward. But I think it's a key part of how we unwind the crises we're in, is I think the more land is stewarded by indigenous peoples, the better off for everybody. And
right.
They're saying indigenous peoples and rights are a solution. And I think that's very true.
Right, right. With land back, definitely it's true with the public lands beginning there. But at the same time, I push that envelope because we're all a part of it. Anyone who owns title to land is a part of that, because I think that's one of those fundamental worldviews of you either own the land or you don't. I mean, is it possible to really straddle the line in the gray? I don't know if it is really. You know, it's kind of like it's a little contradictory.
Yeah. Right? And I think it's such a big topic because there's also like the commons and having lands in the commons.
Exactly.
Where some of the mm-hmm. land needs to be as it was in old Europe and worked very well, where people, right. you know, had a place they lived, but there was the commons where you collected your right. firewood or you could graze your animals. And so we have a lot to do to open up our concepts of getting away from private land ownership. And this is a huge problem that we own the land. And so land back, I think, is a good start because it goes back to indigenous right. peoples yeah. who are the original owners of their land that yeah. whose lands were stolen. So that mm-hmm. makes sense. But I think right. we need to really think about overall how we're going to completely transform our understanding of living on the land and also mm-hmm. making sure that people who don't have access and mm-hmm. you know, are living on the street and are homeless, I mean, they have to fit into this picture as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just a matter of time. I mean, I just put it out there so that we just broaden that perspective, because I know it's not going to go 0 to 60. It's going incrementally, these changes, but it's something that we have to keep questioning and really looking at that, I think, as a source of, you know, that was one of the beginnings, is fencing ourselves off and this is mine, that's yours. That is a huge problem and a fundamental disruptive worldview to truly taking care of the earth, because that makes us separate, right?
Yeah.
And it keeps us there. It keeps us at, this is my fence, that's yours. This is mine, that's yours. And we have this delineation. So it's you know, I know it's not, the time has not come for all of that yet, but I think we're on that evolutionary path. And so, you know, I look forward to that day when land ownership is not something that we are striving for anymore. that that's not where our dependence is for our future or for our security or any of that.
Yeah, I mean, we want a future where everyone has a home, everyone has food, everyone has shelter, everyone has water that's clean. I mean, you know, talk about human rights and our, you know, the beautiful gift of living on this planet. We should not be fighting for those basic human rights. It's insane that we have homeless people. It's insane that we don't have medical attention when we need it. I mean, people accept it because it seems to be the world we're in. But when you think about it, it is crazy that we now develop these hierarchical structures of winners and losers and the wealthy getting everything, and people sort of, so to speak, at the bottom of the pyramid getting nothing, in marginalized communities and all of it through colonization, racism, all of it. Everyone's struggling so hard. And if you just stop, the earth is very abundant and we should all be able to live healthy and cared for. It's just something I think I really hope people hold on to, is that they have the right to have all these things of a basic quality of life with dignity that should belong to everyone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think, as I've said before, with the rights of nature, when we become more balanced and when we are connected to nature, it won't be a right. It'll just be the way we live. You know, we won't have to assert things as a right, because when we're in a healthy, functioning society and taking care of each other, people don't talk about rights. You just do it. That's just the way you live. You know, the way Indigenous peoples live. It's just how they operate. You know, it's a core belief around ethics and ethics in community. Osprey, thank you so much for your advocacy and your book and how you have brought the stories to life in that book for the purpose of regeneration and healing on this planet. I wonder if you could share links of how people can be connected to your work, where they should look for your book. I'm sure it's in all, pretty much all outlets, but if you could share some links.
Sure. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to have a conversation with you. So in terms of our organization, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, people can go to WECAN, WECAN, and then the word international spelled out, .org. So it's WECANinternational.org. And then, yeah, as you say, my book is on all the places. And just would really encourage people to read and share it. It was really meant to be for conversation and to open up conversations like this. So yeah, those are, yeah, where people can go.
Listeners, definitely check out Osprey's book. It is phenomenal. And again, it's going to bring together many different worldviews and again, invite the questioning that we need in this time and also invite us to action. I wanted to share in the closing from the book's foreword, some words by Jyoti, aka KC Camp Hornick of the Ponca Nation. You have the spirit living within you that is connected to all of life. You have the capacity to enact changes that honor all of creation. Mother Earth needs all of our voices and energy in these precious years ahead. And your book is part of that, and encouraging people to continue onward and to open the way forward for future generations to inherit a legacy that is worthy of Mother Earth.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Osprey. More power to many, many people picking up your book and being inspired, and for us all to continue working on behalf of Mother Earth in all her forms.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, How Climate Justice Can Remake a World in Crisis. Thank you to our guest, Osprey Oriel Lake. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you have heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer myself, Jack Eit, co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, an engineer, and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Is KBOO Portland.
Want to be in the know for all things Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com for all the newest episodes and updates.
And don't forget to listen every other Friday live on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. If you're not local, you can also find us live on KBOO.